is also a number, so that every Hebrew word has a numerical value. The words for this world in Hebrew is Olam Hazeh, and by adding the numerical value of each letter, the total numerical value of the word becomes 163. I had heard others do this before, and I enjoyed listening because sometimes they were quite clever and ingenious. I was beginning to feel relaxed again, and I listened carefully.
Hear me now. Listen. How can we make our lives full? How can we fill our lives so that we are 18, chai, and not 9, not half chai?
Rabbi Joshua, son of Levi, teaches us. Whoever does not labor in the Torah is said to be under the divine censure. He is a nozuf, a person whom the master of the universe hates. A righteous man, a tzaddik, studies Torah, for it is written. For his delight is in the Torah of God, and over his Torah does he meditate day and night. In Gematria, Nozuf comes to 143, and Tzaddik comes out 204. What is the difference between Nozuf and Tzaddik? 61. To whom does a Tzaddik dedicate his life? To the master of the universe, La'el, to God. The word La'el in Gematria is 61. It is a life dedicated to God that makes the difference between the Nozuf and the Tzaddik. Another murmur of approval went through the crowd. Reb Saunders was very good at Gematria, I thought. I was really enjoying myself now.
And now listen to me further. In Gematria, the letters of the word Traklin, hall, the hall that refers to the world to come, come out 399, and Prozdor, the vestibule that is this world, comes out 513. Take Traklin from Prozdor, and we have 114. Now listen to me. A righteous man, we said, is 204. A righteous man lives by Torah. Torah is mayim, water. The great and holy rabbis always compare Torah to water. The word mayim in Gematria is 90. Take mayim from tzaddik and we also have 114. From this we learn that the righteous man who removes himself from Torah also removes himself from the world to come.
The whisper of delight was loud this time, and men nodded their heads and smiled. Some of them were even poking each other with their elbows to indicate their pleasure. That one had really been clever. I started to go over it again in my mind.
We see that without Torah, there is only chefa life. We see that without Torah, we are dust. We see that without Torah, we are abominations.
He was saying this quietly, almost as if it were a litany. His eyes were still open, and he was looking directly at Danny now.
When we study Torah, then the master of the universe listens. Then he hears our words. Then he will fulfill our wishes. For the master of the universe promises strength to those who preoccupy themselves in Torah, as it is written, so you may be strong. And he promises length of days, as it is written, so that your days may be lengthened. May Torah be a fountain of waters to all who drink from it, and may it bring us to the Messiah speedily and in our day. Amen.
A chorus of loud and scattered amens answered. I sat in my seat and saw Reb Saunders looking at Danny, then at me. I felt completely at ease, and I somewhat brazenly smiled and nodded, as if to indicate that I had enjoyed his words, or at least the Gematria part of his words. I didn't agree at all with his notions of the world as being contaminated. Albert Einstein is part of the world, I told myself. President Roosevelt is part of the world. The millions of soldiers fighting Hitler are part of the world. I thought that the meal was ended now and we would start the evening service, and I almost began to get out of my seat when I realized that another silence had settled upon the men at the tables. I sat still and looked around. They seemed all to be staring at Danny. He was sitting quietly, smiling a little, his fingers playing with the edge of his paper plate. Reb Saunders sat back in his leather chair and folded his arms across his chest. The little boy was poking at the tomato again and glancing at Danny from the tops of his dark eyes. He twirled the side curl around one of his fingers, and I saw his tongue dart out of his mouth, run over his lips, then dart back in. I wondered what was going on. Reb Saunders sighed loudly and nodded at Danny.
"No, Daniel, you have something to say?"
His voice was quiet, almost gentle. I saw Danny nod his head.
"No? What is it?"
"It is written in the name of Rabbi Yaakov, not Rabbi Meir," Danny said quietly in Yiddish. A whisper of approval came from the crowd. I glanced around quickly. Everyone sat staring at Danny. Reb Saunders almost smiled. He nodded, and the long black beard went back and forth against his chest. Then I saw the thick black eyebrows arch upward and the lids go about halfway down across the eyes. He leaned forward slightly, his arms still folded across his chest.
"And nothing more?"
he asked very quietly. Danny shook his head, a little hesitantly, I thought.
"So," Reb Saunders said, sitting back in the leather chair, "there is nothing more."
I looked at the two of them, wondering what was happening. What was this about Rabbi Yaakov and Rabbi Meir?
"The words were said by Rabbi Yaakov, not by Rabbi Meir," Danny repeated. "Rabbi Yaakov, not Rabbi Meir, said, 'He who is walking by the way and studying, and breaks off his study, and—'"
"Good," Reb Saunders broke in quietly. "The words were said by Rabbi Yaakov. Good. You saw it. Very good. And where is it found?"
"In Pirkei Avos," Danny said. He was giving the Talmudic source for the quote. Many of the quotes Reb Saunders had used had been from Pirkei Avos, or Avot, as my father had taught me to pronounce it, with a Sephardic, rather than the Ashkenazic rendering of the Hebrew letter Toph. I had recognized the quotes easily. Pirkei Avot is a collection of rabbinic maxims, and a chapter of it is studied by many Jews every Shabbat between Passover and the Jewish New Year.
"No?" Reb Saunders said, smiling. "How should you not know that? Of course. Good. Very good. Now, tell me."
As I sat there listening to what then took place between Danny and his father, I slowly realized what I was witnessing. In many Jewish homes, especially homes where there are yeshiva students and where the father is learned, there is a tradition which takes place on Shabbat afternoon. The father quizzes the son on what he has learned in school during the past week. I was witnessing a kind of public quiz, but a strange, almost bizarre quiz, more a contest than a quiz, because Reb Saunders was not confining his questions only to what Danny had learned during the week, but was ranging over most of the major tractates of the Talmud, and Danny was obviously required to provide the answers. Reb Saunders asked where else there was a statement about one who interrupts his studies, and Danny coolly, quietly answered. He asked what a certain medieval commentator had remarked about that statement, and Danny answered. He chose a minute aspect of the answer and asked who had dealt with it in an altogether different way, and Danny answered. He asked whether Danny agreed with this interpretation, and Danny said he did not. He agreed with another medieval commentator, who had given another interpretation. His father asked, how could the commentator have offered such an interpretation when in another passage in the Talmud he had said exactly the opposite? And Danny, very quietly, calmly, his fingers still playing with the rim of the paper plate, found the difference between the contradictory statements by quoting two other sources where one of the statements appeared in a somewhat different context, thereby nullifying the contradiction. One of the two sources Danny had quoted contained a biblical verse, and his father asked him who else had based a law upon this verse. Danny repeated a short passage from the tractate Sanhedrin, and then his father quoted another passage from Yoma, which contradicted the passage in Sanhedrin. And Danny answered with a passage from Gittin, which dissolved the contradiction. His father questioned the validity of his interpretation of the passage in Gittin by citing a commentary on the passage that disagreed with his interpretation. And Danny said it was difficult to understand this commentary. He didn't say the commentary was wrong. He said it was difficult to understand it, because a parallel passage in Nedarim clearly confirmed his own interpretation. This went on and on, until I lost track of the thread that held it all together, and sat and listened in amazement to the feat of memory I was witnessing. Both Danny and his father spoke quietly, his father nodding his approval each time Danny responded. Danny's brother sat staring at them with his mouth open, finally lost interest and began to eat some of the food that was still on his plate. Once he started picking his nose, but stopped immediately. The men around the tables were watching as if in ecstasy, their faces glowing with pride. This was almost like the pill pull my father had told me about, except that this wasn't really pill pull. They weren't twisting the text out of shape. They seemed more interested in bikyut, in straightforward knowledge and simple explanations of the Talmudic passages and commentaries they were discussing. It went on like that for a long time. Then Reb Saunders sat back and was silent. The contest, or quiz, had apparently ended, and Reb Saunders was smiling at his son. He said very quietly,
"Good, very good. There is no contradiction. But tell me, you have nothing more to say about what I said earlier?"
Danny was suddenly sitting very straight.
"Nothing more?" Reb Saunders asked again. "You have nothing more to say?"
Danny shook his head hesitantly.
"Absolutely nothing more to say," Reb Saunders insisted, his voice flat, cold, distant.
He was no longer smiling.
I saw Danny's body go rigid again, as it had done before his father began to speak. The ease and certainty he had worn during the Talmud quiz had disappeared.
"So," Reb Saunders said, "there is nothing more. No? What should I say?"
"I did not hear."
"You did not hear. You did not hear. You heard the first mistake, and you stopped listening. Of course you did not hear. How could you hear when you were not listening?"
He said it quietly and without anger. Danny's face was rigid. The crowd sat silent. I looked at Danny. For a long moment he sat very still, and then I saw his lips part, move, curve slowly upward and freeze into a grin. I felt the skin on the back of my neck begin to crawl, and I almost cried out. I stared at him, then looked quickly away. Reb Saunders sat looking at his son. Then he turned his eyes upon me. I felt his eyes looking at me. There was a long, dark silence, during which Danny sat very still, staring fixedly at his plate and grinning. Reb Saunders began to play with the earlock along the right side of his face. He caressed it with the fingers of his right hand, wound it around the index finger, released it, then caressed it again, all the time, looking at me. Finally, he sighed loudly, shook his head, and put his hands on the table.
"No," he said. "It is possible I am not right. After all, my son is not a mathematician. He has a good head on him, but it is not a head for mathematics. But we have a mathematician with us. The son of David Malter is with us. He is a mathematician."
He was looking straight at me, and I felt my heart pound and the blood drain from my face.
"Reuven,"
Reb Saunders was saying, looking straight at me,
"you have nothing to say?"
I found I couldn't open my mouth. Say about what? I hadn't the faintest idea what he and Danny had been talking about.
"You heard my little talk?"
Reb Saunders asked me quietly.
I felt my head nod.
"And you have nothing to say?"
I felt his eyes on me and found myself staring down at the table. The eyes were like flames on my face.
Reuven, you liked the gematria?
Reb Saunders asked softly. I looked up and nodded. Danny hadn't moved at all. He just sat there, grinning. His little brother was playing with the tomato again, and the men at the tables were silent, staring at me now.
I'm very happy, Reb Saunders said gently. You liked the gematria. Which gematria did you like?
I heard myself say lamely and hoarsely, they were all very good. Reb Saunders' eyebrows went up.
All, he said, a very nice thing. They were all very good. Reuven, were they all very good?
I felt Danny stir and saw him turn his head, the grin gone now from his lips. He glanced at me quickly, then looked down again at his paper plate. I looked at Reb Saunders.
No,
I heard myself say hoarsely.
They were not all good.
There was a stir from the men at the tables. Reb Saunders sat back in his leather chair.
No, Reuven, he said quietly. Tell me, which one was not good?
One of the gematriot was wrong, I said. I thought the world would fall in on me after I said that. I was a 15-year-old boy, and there I was telling Reb Saunders he had been wrong. But nothing happened. There was another stir from the crowd, but nothing happened. Instead, Reb Saunders broke into a warm, broad smile.
And which one was it?
He asked me quietly.
The gematria for Prosdor is 503, not 513, I answered.
Good. Very good,
Reb Saunders said, smiling and nodding his head, the black beard going back and forth against his chest, the earlock swaying.
Very good, Reuven. The gematria for Prosdor comes out 503. Very good.
He looked at me, smiling broadly, his teeth showing white through the beard, and I almost thought I saw his eyes mist over. There was a loud murmur from the crowd, and Danny's body sagged as the tension went out of him. He glanced at me, his face a mixture of surprise and relief, and I realized with astonishment that I, too, had just passed some kind of test.
No?
Reb Saunders said loudly to the men around the tables.
Say Kaddish.
An old man stood up and recited the scholar's Kaddish. Then the congregants broke to go back to the front section of the synagogue for the evening service. Danny and I said nothing to each other throughout the service, and though I prayed the words, I didn't know what I was saying. I kept going over what had happened at the table. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't get it through my head that Danny had to go through something like that every week, and that I myself had gone through it tonight. The followers of Reb Saunders obviously had been pleased with my performance, because I could see they were no longer staring questions at me, but were glancing at me admiringly. One of them, an old man with a white beard who was sitting in my row, even nodded at me and smiled, the corners of his eyes crinkling. I had clearly passed the test. What a ridiculous way to gain admiration and friendship! The evening service was over very quickly, and afterward, one of the younger men chanted the Havdalah, the brief service that marks the end of the Shabbat. Danny's brother held the braided candle, his hand trembling a little as the molten wax spilled onto his fingers. Then the congregants wished one another and Reb Saunders a good week and began to leave the synagogue. It was late, and I thought my father would probably be worried about me by now, but I stood there and waited until the last congregant was gone and the synagogue was empty, except for me, Danny, Reb Saunders, and the little boy. The synagogue seemed to me suddenly very small without its throng of black-hatted, black-bearded, black-caftaned men. Reb Saunders was stroking his beard and looking at Danny and me. He leaned an elbow upon the large podium, and then the hand that was stroking the beard began to play with an earlock. I heard him sigh and saw him shake his head slowly, his dark eyes moist and brooding.
Reuven,
You have a good head on you, he said quietly in Yiddish. I am happy my Daniel has chosen you for a friend. My son has many friends, but he doesn't talk about them the way he talks about you. I listened and said nothing. His voice was gentle, almost a caress. He seemed so altogether different now from the way he had been at the table. I glanced at Danny. He was looking at his father, and the rigid lines were gone from his face. Reb Saunders clasped his hands behind his back.
I know of your father, he said to me quietly. I'm not surprised you have such a head. Your father is a great scholar. But what he writes, oh, what he writes.
He shook his head.
I worry myself about my son's friends, especially if such a friend is the son of David Malter. Ah, what your father writes. Criticism, scientific criticism. Ah, so when he tells me you are now his friend, I worry myself. The son of David Malter should be my Daniel's friend. But your father is an observer of the commandments, and you have his head, and so I am happy you are friends. It is good my Daniel has a friend. I have many responsibilities. I am not always able to talk to him. I saw Danny stare down at the floor, his face hardening. It is good he has acquired a friend. Just so his friend does not teach him scientific criticism.
Reb Saunders looked at me, his eyes dark and brooding.
You think a friend is an easy thing to be? If you are truly his friend, you will discover otherwise.
We will see.
No, it is late, and your father is certainly worried that you are away so long.
Have a good week, Reuven,
and come pray with us again. There will be no more mistakes in Gematria.
He was smiling broadly and warmly now, his eyes wrinkling at the corners, the hard lines of his face almost gone. And then he offered me his hand, his entire hand this time, not only the fingers. And I took it, and he held my hand a long time. I almost had the feeling he wanted to embrace me. Then our hands separated, and he went slowly up the aisle, his hands clasped behind his back, tall, a little stooped, and, I thought, a little majestic. His young son trailed behind him, holding on to the caftan. Danny and I remained alone in the synagogue. It occurred to me suddenly that not a single word had passed between him and his father all evening, except for the Talmud contest.
I'll walk you part of the way home, Danny offered.
And we went out of the brownstone and down the stone stairway to the street. I could hear the caps of his shoes clearly against the stone of the stairway, and then against the cement pavement of the sidewalk. It was night now, and cool, and a breeze blew against the sycamores and moved softly through the leaves. We walked in silence until Lee Avenue, then turned left. I was walking quickly, and Danny kept pace with my steps. Walking along Lee Avenue, Danny said quietly,
I know what you're thinking. You think he's a tyrant.
I shook my head.
I don't know what to think. One minute he's a tyrant, the next minute he's kind and gentle. I don't know what to think.
He's got a lot on his mind, Danny said. He's a pretty complicated person.
Do you always go through that routine at the table?
Oh, sure. I don't mind it. I even enjoy it a little.
I've never seen anything like it in my life.
It's a family tradition, Danny explained. My father's father used to do it with him. It goes all the way back.
It would scare me sick. It's not that bad.
The bad part is waiting until he makes the mistake.
After that, it's all right.
But the mistakes aren't really very hard to find. He makes ones that he knows I can find.
It's a kind of game, almost.
Some game. The second mistake tonight caught me off guard. But he made that one for you, really.
That was very good, the way you caught it.
He knew I wouldn't catch it. He just wanted to catch me so he could tell me I wasn't listening. He was right, I wasn't listening. But I wouldn't have caught it even if I had listened. I'm no good at math.
I've got a photographic memory for everything except math. You can't memorize math. You have to have a certain kind of head for it.
I hate to tell you what I think about that game, I said, a little heatedly. What happens if you miss the mistake? I haven't missed in years. What happens when you do miss?
He was silent a moment.
It's uncomfortable for a while, he said quietly. But he makes a joke or something, and we go into a Talmud discussion.
What a game, I said. In front of all those people?
They love it, Danny said. They're very proud to see us like that. They love to hear the Talmud discussed like that. Did you see their faces?
I saw them, I said.
How could I not see them?
Does your father always use gematria when he talks?
Not always. Very rarely, as a matter of fact. The people love it and always hope for it, but he does it rarely. I think he did it tonight only because you were there.
He's good at it. I'll say that much.
He wasn't too good tonight. Some of it was a little forced.
He was fantastic a few months ago. He did it with Talmudic laws then. He was really great.
I thought it wasn't bad tonight.
Well, it wasn't too good. He hasn't been feeling too well.
He's worried about my brother.
What's wrong with your brother?
I don't know. They don't talk about it. Something about his blood. He's been sick for a few years now.
I'm sorry to hear that, Danny.
He'll be all right.
There's a pretty big doctor taking care of him now. He'll be all right.
His voice had the same strange quality it had had when he had talked about his brother on our way over to the synagogue earlier in the day. Hope, wistfulness, almost an eagerness for something to take place. I thought Danny must love his little brother very much, though I didn't remember his saying a word to him all the time they had been together.
Anyway, Danny said, these contests, as you call them, are going to end as soon as I start studying with Rav Gershenson.
Who?
Rav Gershenson. He's a great scholar. He's at Hirsch College. He teaches Talmud there. My father says that when I'm old enough to study with Rav Gershenson, I'll be old enough for him not to worry whether I can catch him at mistakes or not. Then we'll just have the Talmud discussions.
I like that.
I was restraining my delight with considerable difficulty. The Samson Raphael Hirsch Seminary and College was the only yeshiva in the United States that offered a secular college education. It was located on Bedford Avenue, a few blocks from Eastern Parkway. My father had told me once that it had been built in the early 20s by a group of Orthodox Jews who wanted their sons to have both a Jewish and a secular education. Its college faculty was supposed to be excellent, and its rabbinic faculty consisted of some of the greatest Talmudists in the United States. A rabbinic ordination from its Talmud faculty was looked upon as the highest of Orthodox Jewish honors. It had been a foregone conclusion on my father's part and on mine that I would go on to there after high school for my bachelor's degree. When I told Danny that, his face burst into a smile.
"Well, that's wonderful," he said. "I'm happy to hear that. That's really wonderful."
"So we'll be going to the same college," I said.
"Will you be going for a B.A.?"
"Sure, you have to. They don't let you study just Talmud in that college. I'll be majoring in psychology." We had come to the corner of the synagogue in which my father and I prayed. Danny stopped.
"I have to go back," he said. "I've got schoolwork to do."
"I'll call you at your house tomorrow afternoon."
"I'll probably be in the library tomorrow afternoon, doing some reading in psychology. Why don't you come over there?"
"I won't be able to read anything."
"That's right," Danny smiled.
"I forgot. You didn't duck."
"I'll come over anyway. I'll sit and think while you read."
"Wonderful. I'd like to watch you sit and think."
"Mitnagdim can think too, you know," I said.
Danny laughed.
"I'll see you tomorrow."
"Right,"
I said, and watched him walk away, tall and lean in his black kaftan and black hat. I hurried home and came into the apartment just as my father was beginning to dial the phone. He put the phone down and looked at me.
"Do you know what time it is?" he asked.
"Is it very late?" I glanced at my watch. It was almost 10:30. "I'm sorry, Abba. I couldn't just walk out."
"You were at Reb Saunders' synagogue all this time?"
"Yes."
Next time you're out so late, you will call, yes? I was ready to telephone Reb Saunders to find out what happened. Come into the kitchen and sit down. What are you looking so excited about? Sit down, I'll make some tea. Did you eat? What happened that you were away so long? I sat at the kitchen table and slowly told my father everything that had taken place in Reb Saunders' synagogue. He sipped his tea and listened quietly. I saw him grimace when I began to go over the gematriot. My father didn't particularly care for gematria. He had once referred to it as nonsense numerology and had said that anything could be proved that way. All that had to be done was to shift letters around adroitly so as to make the values come out any way you wanted. So he sat there, sipping his tea and grimacing, as I reviewed Reb Saunders' gematriot. When I started to tell him what had happened afterward, the grimace left his face, and he listened intently, nodding his head from time to time and sipping his tea. And when I got to the part where Reb Saunders had asked me about the wrong gematria, his face took on a look of astonishment, and he put the glass down on the table. Then I told him what Reb Saunders had said to me after Havdalah, and what Danny and I had talked about on the way home, and he smiled proudly and nodded to indicate his happiness.
"Well," my father said, sipping his tea again, "you had some day, Reuven."
"It was an experience, Abba. The way Danny had to answer his father's questions like that in front of everybody, I thought that was terrible." My father shook his head.
"It is not terrible, Reuven. Not for Danny, not for his father, and not for the people who listened. It is an old tradition, this kind of Talmudic discussion. I have seen it many times between great rabbis, but it doesn't only take place between rabbis. When Kant became a professor, he had to follow an old tradition and argue in public on a philosophical subject. One day, when you are a professor in a university and read a paper before your colleagues, you will also have to answer questions. It's a part of Danny's training."
"But in public like that, Abba?"
"Yes, Reuven, in public like that. How else would Reb Saunders' people know that Danny has a head for Talmud?"
"It just seemed so cruel to me." My father nodded.
"It is a little cruel, Reuven. But that is the way the world is. If a person has a contribution to make, he must make it in public. If learning is not made public, it is a waste. But the business about the mistakes I never heard before. That is something new. That is Reb Saunders' innovation. It is clear, but I'm not sure I like it very much. No, I do not think I like it at all."
"Danny said the mistakes are always easy to find."
"Perhaps," my father said. "A man can do whatever he wishes to test his son's knowledge. But there are other ways than the way of Reb Saunders. At any rate, Reuven, it is good training for Danny. He will be involved in such things all his life."
"Reb Saunders is a very complicated man, Abba. I can't make him out. One minute he's hard and angry, the next minute he's soft and gentle. I don't understand him."
"Reb Saunders is a great man, Reuven. Great men are always difficult to understand. He carries the burden of many people on his shoulders. I do not care for his Hasidism very much, but it isn't a simple task to be a leader of people. Reb Saunders is not a fraud. He would be a great man even if he hadn't inherited his post from his father. It is a pity he occupies his mind only with Talmud. If he were not a tzaddik, he could make a great contribution to the world. But he lives only in his own world. It's a great pity. Danny will be the same way when he takes his father's place. It's a shame that a mind such as Danny's will be shut off from the world." My father sipped his tea again, and we sat quietly for a while.
"I'm very proud of the way you handled yourself today," my father said, looking at me over the rim of the glass. "I'm glad Reb Saunders will let you be Danny's friend. I was worried about Reb Saunders."
"I'm awfully sorry I came back so late, Abba." My father nodded.
"I'm not angry," he said. "But next time you will be so late, you will call, yes?"
"Yes, Abba."
My father glanced at the clock on the shelf over the refrigerator.
"Reuven,
It's late, and tomorrow you are going to school. You should go to sleep now.
Yes, Abba.
Remember, you mustn't read. I will read to you in the evenings, and we will see if we can study that way, but you mustn't read by yourself.
Yes, Abba. Good night.
Good night, Reuven.
I left him sitting at the kitchen table over his glass of tea and went to bed. I lay awake a long time before I was able to sleep.
Chapter 8. When I got back to school the next morning, I found I had become a hero. And during the 15-minute morning recess, my friends, and even some boys I didn't know, all crowded around me, wanting to know how I was, and telling me what a great game I had played. Near the end of recess, I went over to the pitcher's position and stood on the exact spot where I had been hit by the ball. I looked, tried to look, the yard was crowded with students, at home plate, and imagined Danny standing there, grinning at me. I remembered his grinning that way again yesterday, and I closed my eyes for a moment, then went over and stood near the wire fence behind the plate. The bench on which the young rabbi had sat was still there, and I stared at it for a moment. It seemed impossible to me that the ball game had taken place only a week ago. So many things had happened, and everything looked so different. Sidney Goldberg came over to me and started talking about the game, and then Davy Cantor joined us and added his opinion about those murderers. I nodded at what they were saying without really listening. It seemed silly to me. The way they kept talking about the game, they both sounded so childish. And I got a little angry when Davy Cantor started talking about that snooty Danny Saunders, but I didn't say anything. I got out of school at 2 o'clock and took a trolley car over to the public library where I was supposed to meet Danny. The library was a huge 3-story gray stone building with thick Ionic columns, and with the words, "Beauty is truth, truth beauty, that is all ye know on earth, and all you need to know," John Keats, engraved in the stone over its 4 glass entrance doors. It stood on a wide boulevard, and there were tall trees in front of it, and a grassy lawn bordered by flowers. On the right-hand wall of the vestibule, just inside the doors, there was a mural of the history of great ideas, beginning with a drawing of Moses holding the 10 Commandments, going on to Jesus, Muhammad, Galileo, Luther, Copernicus, Kepler, Newton, and ending with Einstein, gazing at the formula E equals MC squared. On the other wall there was a mural showing Homer, Dante, Tolstoy, Balzac, and Shakespeare engaged in conversation. They were beautiful murals, done in bright colors, and the great men in them looked alive. Probably because I had become so sensitive about eyes the past week, I noticed for the first time that Homer's eyes seemed glazed, almost without pupils, as if the artist had been trying to show that he had been blind. I'd never noticed that before, and it frightened me a little to see it now. I went quickly through the first floor, with its marble floors, its marble pillars, its tall bookcases, its long reference tables, its huge windows through which the sun streamed, and its glass-topped desks at which the librarian sat. I found Danny on the 3rd floor against the far wall, partly hidden by a bookcase, wearing a black suit, a tie-less shirt, and a skull cap. He was sitting at a small table, bent over a book, his long earlocks dangling down the sides of his face and almost reaching to the top of the table. There were not many people on this floor. Its stacks were filled mostly with bound volumes of scholarly journals and pamphlets. It was a large floor, and the closely set stacks gave it a maze-like appearance. They went from floor to ceiling, and they seemed to me to contain everything of importance that had ever been written on any subject in the world. There were journals in English, French, German, Russian, Italian, and even one collection in Chinese. Some of the English journals had names I couldn't pronounce. This was the one floor of the 3-floored library I didn't know well. I had been up here once to find an article in the Journal of Symbolic Logic, which had been recommended to me by my mathematics teacher, an article which I had only dimly understood, and once to meet my father.
Now was the third time in all the years I had belonged to this library that I was on its third floor. I stood near a bookcase a few feet away from the table at which Danny was sitting, and I watched him read. His elbows were on the table, and he held his head in the palms of his hands, the fingers covering his ears completely, his eyes staring down at the book. Occasionally, the fingers of his right hand would play with his earlock, and once they stroked the tufts of sand-colored hair on his chin for a few seconds, then went back to the side of his face. His mouth was slightly open, and I couldn't see his eyes. They were hidden by the lids. He seemed impatient each time he came to the foot of a page, and he flipped the page with a quick gesture of his right hand, wetting the forefinger with his tongue and turning the page by pushing upward with the finger against the lower right-hand corner, the way one does a page of Talmud. Except that with a Talmud, the left forefinger usually pushes against the lower left-hand corner, because it is read from right to left. He was reading with phenomenal speed. I could almost see him read. He would start at the head of a page, his head tilted slightly upward, and then his head would move downward in a straight line until he got to the foot of the page. Then it would tilt upward again and either move sideways to the right page or remain fixed in its upward position until the page was turned, and then start downward again. He didn't seem to be reading from side to side, but up and down. And watching him, I had the distinct impression that he was reading the middle of the page only, and was somehow able to ignore or absorb without actually reading what was written on the sides. I decided not to disturb him, and I sat down at another table a few feet away and continued to watch him read. It was frustrating to be sitting there surrounded by all those journals and not be able to read a thing myself, and I decided after a while to review by heart some of the symbolic logic I had been studying. I closed my eyes and went over the propositional calculus, trying to visualize the truth tables for conjunction, disjunction, equivalence, and material implication. They were fairly simple, and I had no difficulty. I tried to do some problems, but after a while it became complicated. I couldn't remember all the deductive steps, and I stopped. I was about to begin going over the steps of indirect proof when I heard Danny say, "You're always sleeping. What a sleepyhead you are." And I opened my eyes. Danny was sitting up in his chair and looking at me. "I was reviewing my logic," I told him. "I wasn't sleeping." "Of course," he said, smiling, but his voice sounded sad. "I was just going into the indirect proof. Do you want to hear it?" "No, I can't stand that stuff. Why didn't you tell me you were here?" "I didn't want to disturb you." "You're nice, for a miznaged." He gave the Hebrew letter Tof its Ashkenazic pronunciation. "Come over here. I want you to see something." I went over to his table and sat down next to him. "I'm not allowed to read, you know." "I want you to hear this. I'll read it to you." "What is it?" "It's from Gretz's History of the Jews." He sounded unhappy, and there was a somber look on his face. "It's about Hasidim. Listen. Gretz is talking about Dov Baer, who was the follower of the Besht. He just finished saying that Dov Baer invented the idea of the tzaddik." He looked down at the book on the table and began to read aloud. "Baer's idea, however, was not meant to remain idle and unfruitful, but to bring him honor and revenue. While the tzaddik cared for the conduct of the world, for the obtaining of heavenly grace, and especially for Israel's preservation and glorification, his adherents had to cultivate three kinds of virtues. It was their duty to draw nigh to him, to enjoy the sight of him, and from time to time to make pilgrimages to him. Further, they were to confess their sins to him. By these means alone could they hope for pardon from their iniquities." "That means sins," he told me. "I know what it means," I said. He went on. "Finally, they had to bring him presents, rich gifts, which he knew how to employ to the best advantage. It was also incumbent upon them to attend to his personal wants. It seems like a return to the days of the priests of Baal. So vulgar and disgusting do these perversities appear. He looked up from the book. That's pretty strong language. Vulgar and disgusting. His eyes were dark and brooding. It feels terrible to have a great scholar like Gretz call Hasidism vulgar and disgusting. I never thought of my father as a priest of Baal. I didn't say anything. Listen to what else he says about Dov Be'er. He turned a page. He says here that Dov Be'er used to crack vulgar jokes to make his people happy, and that he used to encourage his followers to drink alcohol so they would pray fervently. He says that Rabbi Elijah of Vilna was a great opponent of the Hasidim, and that when he died... Let me read it to you. He shuffled pages. Here it is. Listen. After his death, the Hasidim took vengeance upon him by dancing upon his grave and celebrating the day of his decease as a holiday with shouting and drunkenness. He looked at me. I never knew about any of these things. You were in our shul yesterday. Did anyone look drunk to you during the service? No, I said. My father isn't like that at all. His voice was sad, and it trembled a little. He really worries about his people. He worries about them so much, he doesn't even have time to talk to me. Maybe Gretz is only talking about the Hasidim of his own day, I offered. Maybe, he said, not convinced. It's awful to have someone give you an image like that of yourself. He says that Dov Be'er had expert spies worthy of serving in the Secret Service. Those are his words. Worthy of serving in the Secret Service. He says they would go around discovering people's secrets and tell them to Dov Be'er. People who came to see him about their personal problems would have to wait around until the Saturday after they came, and in the meantime, these spies would investigate them and report back to him, so that when the person finally got to see him, Dov Be'er would know everything. And the person would be impressed and think that Dov Be'er had some sort of magical ability to look into his heart. He shuffled some more pages. Listen to this. In the first interview, Be'er, in a seemingly casual manner, was able, in a skillfully arranged discourse, to bring in allusions to these strangers, whereby they would be convinced that he had looked into their hearts and knew their past. He shook his head sadly. I never knew about anything like that. When my father talks about Dov Be'er, he almost makes him out to be a saint. Did my father give you that book to read? Your father said I should read Jewish history. He said the first important step in anyone's education is to know your own people. So, I found this work by Gretz. It's a lot of volumes. I'm almost done with it. This is the last volume. He shook his head again, and the earlocks danced and brushed against the ridge of his jaw and the hollow of his cheeks. What an image it gives me of myself. You ought to discuss it with my father first, I told him, before you go believing any of that. He told me a lot about Hasidism on Friday night. He wasn't very complimentary, but he didn't say anything about drunkenness. Danny nodded slowly. I'll talk to him, he said. But Gretz was a great scholar. I read up on him before I started reading his history. He was one of the greatest Jewish scholars of the last century. You ought to discuss it with my father, I repeated. Danny nodded again, then slowly closed the book. His fingers played idly with the spine of the binding. You know, he brooded, I read a psychology book last week in which the author said that the most mysterious thing in the universe to man is man himself. We're blind about the most important thing in our lives, our own selves. How could a man like Dov Be'er have the gall to fool other people into thinking that he could look inside their hearts and tell them what they were really like inside? You don't know that he did. You only know Gretz's version of it. He ignored me. I had the feeling he was talking more to himself than to me. We're so complicated inside, he went on quietly.
There's something in us called the unconscious that we're completely unaware of. It practically dominates our lives, and we don't even know it. He paused, hesitating, his hand moving from the book and playing now with an earlock. I was reminded of the evening in the hospital when he had stared out the window at the people on the street below, and had talked of God and ants and the reading he did in this library. "There's so much to read," he said. "I've only really been reading for a few months. Did you know about the subconscious?" he asked me, and when I somewhat hesitantly nodded, he said, "You see? You're not even interested in psychology, and you know about it. I have so much catching up to do." He was suddenly conscious of the way his fingers were playing with the earlock, and he let his hand drop to the table. "Did you know that very often the subconscious expresses itself in dreams? The dream is the product of a transaction between conscious and unconscious wishes," he quoted, "and the results during sleep are naturally very different from those during waking hours." "What's this about dreams?" I asked. "It's true," he said. "Dreams are full of unexpressed fears and hopes, things that we never even think of consciously. We think of them unconsciously deep down inside ourselves, and they come out in dreams. They don't always come out straight, though. Sometimes they come out in symbols. You have to learn to interpret the symbols." "Where did you find out about that?" "In my reading. There's a lot of work been done on dreams. It's one of the ways they have of getting to a person's unconscious." I must have had a strange expression on my face because he asked me what was the matter. "I dream all the time," I told him. "Everyone does," he said. "We just don't remember a lot of them. We repress them. We sort of push them away and forget them because sometimes they're too painful." "I'm trying to remember mine," I said. "Some of them weren't very pleasant." "A lot of times they're not pleasant. Our unconscious isn't a nice place. I call it a place. It isn't a place, really. The book I read says it's more like a process. It isn't a nice place at all. It's full of repressed fears and hatreds, things that we're afraid to bring out into the open." "And these things rule our lives?" "According to some psychologists, they do." "You mean these things go on and we don't know anything about them?" "That's right. That's what I said before. What's inside us is the greatest mystery of all." "That's a pretty sad thing to think about, to be doing things without really knowing why you're doing them." Danny nodded. "You can find out about it, though. About your unconscious, I mean. That's what psychoanalysis is all about. I haven't read too much about it yet, but it's a long process. Freud started it. You've heard about Freud. He started psychoanalysis. I'm teaching myself German so I can read him in the original. He discovered the unconscious, too." I stared at him and felt a shock of coldness move inside me. "You're studying German?" He seemed surprised at my reaction. "What's wrong with studying German? Freud wrote in German. What are you looking at me like that for?"
"Aren't his writings translated into English?"
"Not all of them. Besides, I want to read a lot of other things in German that haven't been translated yet." "What's the matter with you? You've got the funniest look on your face."
I didn't say anything.
"Just because Hitler speaks German doesn't mean that the language is corrupt. It's the most important scientific language in the world. What are you looking at me like that for?"
"I'm sorry," I said. "It just seems strange to me. You're studying German."
"What's so strange about it?"
"Nothing."
"How are you teaching it to yourself?"
"There's a grammar book in the reference library. I'm almost done memorizing it. It's an interesting language, very technical and precise. It's amazing the way they put nouns together. Do you know what the word for mysterious is in German?"
"I don't know any German."
"It's geheimnisvoll. It means full of secret. That's what the subconscious is, geheimnisvoll. The word for sympathetic is teilnahmsvoll, literally full of partaking.
The word for charity is Nächstenliebe. Literally, it means...
All right, I said. I'm impressed.
It's quite a language. Yiddish is a lot like it. Yiddish was originally Middle German. When the German Jews came into Poland, they brought it with them.
You mean in the 13th century, when Poland encouraged the Jews to come in?
That's right.
You know about that?
I didn't know about Yiddish being German.
My father doesn't either. At least, I don't think he does. He thinks Yiddish is almost holy.
But it's really from Middle German.
I was going to ask him what the middle meant in Middle German, but I decided not to push the conversation any further. I was upset enough as it was about his learning German, and it had nothing to do with Hitler either. I kept remembering what my father had told me about Solomon Maimon. It all sounded so weird. I almost had the feeling I was talking to Maimon's ghost. We talked some more about Gretz's version of Hasidism, and then somehow we got into the subject of Danny's brother. He had been examined by a big doctor that morning, and the doctor had said he would be all right, but that he would have to be careful, no strenuous studying or exercising. He had gone with his father, and Danny said his father was now very upset, but at least his brother would be all right. It had something to do with his blood chemistry, Danny said, and the doctor had prescribed 3 different pills for him to take. He hadn't been very optimistic about the condition clearing up, either. He said he would have to take the pills as long as it persisted.
It might persist his whole life, Danny said sadly.
Again, I got the impression that he loved his brother very much, and I wondered why he hadn't said a word to him during all the time I had seen them together yesterday in the synagogue. Finally, we decided it was getting late, and we started down the wide marble staircase. When we were about halfway down the staircase to the 2nd floor, Danny stopped and looked carefully around. He did the same when we were going down to the main floor. He replaced the Gretz book, and we went outside. It was cloudy and seemed ready to rain, so we decided to take a trolley car back rather than walk. Danny got off at his block, and I rode the rest of the way alone, my head full of what we had talked about, especially his teaching himself German. I told my father about it over the supper table.
"What does Danny want to read in German?" he asked me.
"He wants to read Freud." My father's eyes went wide behind their spectacles. "He was very excited about it," I said. "He was talking about the unconscious and dreams. He was also reading Gretz on Hasidism."
"The unconscious and dreams," my father muttered. "And Freud,
at the age of 15.